Sometimes, Avitas, I sigh, I wish you'd say what you're actually thinking. Come along on the raid, then, I say, and at his look of surprise I roll my eyes. I'm not a fool, Harper. Let's keep her on her toes. There's something else. A worry has grown in my mind, something no general would publicly speak of before a battle, but something I must consider, especially after talking to Livia of the plebeians. Do we have exit routes mapped out of the city? Paths through which we could move large groups of people? I'll dig them up. Do it before we leave, I say. Give orders, quietly, to make sure those paths are clear and that we protect them at all costs. You think we cannot hold back the Karkans? I think that if they're in league with Karras, it is foolish to underestimate them. We might not know what she's playing at, but we can prepare for the worst. We move out the next morning, and I force Karras and her machinations from my mind. If I can rout Grimar's forces, or at least weaken them, before they get to Antium, she'll lose her chance to take Marcus down, and I'll be the hero instead of her. The Karkans are 12 days from the city, but my force can move faster than theirs. My men and I have 5 days to make life as hellish as possible for them. Our smaller force allows us to ride swiftly, and on the evening of the third day, our scouts confirm that the Karkan force has, as Dex reported, gathered at Umbral Pass. They have Tundaran wildmen with them. That's likely how Grimar figured out the way through. Those women-hating Tundaran bastards know these mountains almost as well as the marshals do. Why the hells are they just waiting there? I ask Dex. They should be clear of the pass by now and out into open country. Waiting for more men, perhaps, Dex says, though their force doesn't seem much bigger than when I saw it. I send my cousin Baristus out to recon the north end of the pass to see if, indeed, more Karkans are joining the main body of the army. But when he returns, he brings only questions. Blading strange, sir, Baristus says. As Dex, Avitas, and I gather in my tent, my cousin paces back and forth, agitated. There are no more men coming in through the northern passes. Truly, it appears they are waiting. But for what? I cannot tell. I thought it might be weaponry or artillery for their siege machines. But they have no siege machines. How the bleeding hells do they plan to get past the walls of Antium without catapults? Maybe Karras promised to let them in, I say, and they don't yet realize how devious she is. It would be just like her to play both sides. And then what? Dex says. She lets them lay siege for a few weeks? Enough time for her to find a way to get Marcus killed in the fighting, I say. Enough time for her to sabotage the birth of my nephew. Ultimately, it is the Empire that Karras wishes to rule over. She will not let the capital of the Empire fall. But the loss of a few thousand lives? That's nothing to her. I've learned that lessonwell. If we rout the Karkans here, I say, then we kill her plan before it draws its first breath. I examine the drawings the Orcs has given me of the layout of the Karkan army camp. Their food stores, their weaponry, the locations of their various provisions. They've buried their most valuable goods in the very heart of the army, where they will be almost impossible to reach. But I have masks with me, and the word impossible has been whipped and beaten out of us. My force strikes deep in the night, when much of the Karkan camp is sleeping. The sentries go down swiftly, and Dex leads a force that is in and out before the first flames rise from the Karkan food stores. We hit perhaps a sixth of their supply, but by the time our enemies sound the alarm, we have retreated back into the mountains. I'll come with you for the next assault, Shrike, Harper says to me as we prepare for another. Something feels wrong to me. They took that attack lying down. Perhaps it's because we surprised them. Harper paces nervously, and I put a hand on his shoulder to still him. A spark jumps between us, and he looks up in surprise. Immediately I let him go. I need you with the rear guard, I say to cover my awkwardness. If something does go wrong, I'll need you to get the men back to Antium. Our next assault comes just before dawn, when the barbarians are still scrambling from our earlier attack. This time I lead a group of 100 men, armed with arrows and flame. But almost before the first volley flies, it is clear that the Karkans are ready for us. A wave of more than 1,000 of them on our western side breaks off from the main army and surges upward in orderly, organized lines that I've never seen in a Karkan force. But we have the higher ground, so we pick off as many as we can. They have no horses, and these mountains are not their land. They don't know these hills the way we do. When we've exhausted our arrows, I signal the retreat, which is when the unmistakable thud of a drum thunders out from the rear guard. Arvatus's troops. One deep thud. Two. Three. Ambush. We worked out the warnings ahead of time. I spin about, my warhammer in hand, waiting for the attack. The men close ranks. A horse screams, a chilling and unmistakable sound. Curses ring out when the drum sounds again. But this time, the drum is unceasing, a frantic call for aid. The rear guard is under attack, Dex calls out. How the hell's... His sentence ends in a grunt as he parries a knife that comes flying out at him from the woods. And then we can think of nothing but surviving, because we are suddenly surrounded by Karkans. They rise up from well-hidden traps in the ground, drop down from trees, rain down arrows and blades and fire. From the rear guard we hear the unholy howling of more Karkans as they pour down the mountain from the east. Thousands of them. More still approach from the north. Only the south is clear, but not for long, if we don't clear this ambush. We're dead. We're bleeding dead. That ravine! I point to a narrow path between the closing pincer of the approaching forces, and we make a break for it, sending arrows back over our shoulders. The ravine follows the river, leading down to a waterfall. There are boats there, enough to take the remaining men downstream. Faster! They're closing! We run full force, grimacing at the screams of the rear guard dying swiftly as they are inundated by our enemy. Skies! So many men! So many black guards! And Arvatus is up there. Something feels wrong to me. If he'd been with us, he might have seen the ambush. We might have retreated before the Karkans attacked the rear guard. And now, I look up the mountain. He could not possibly survive that onslaught. None of them could. There are too many. He never told Elias that they are brothers. He never got to speak to Elias as a brother. And Skies, the things I've said to him in moments of rage, in anger, when all he did was try to help keep me alive. That spark between us extinguished before I could put a name to it. My eyes burn. Shrike! Dex screams and knocks me to the ground as an arrow cuts through the air, nearly impaling me. We scramble up and stumble on. The ravine finally appears, an 8-foot drop into the remnants of a creek. A hail of arrows comes down as we approach it. Shields! I shout. Steel thunks on wood, and then my men and I run again, years of training pushing us into neat rows. Every time a soldier is picked off, another moves to take his place, so that when I look back, I can count almost exactly how many are left. Only 75 of the 500 markers sent. We hurtle down the path beside the falls, and the thunder of the water drives away any other sound. The path curves back and forth on itself until it drops into a dusty flat where a dozen longboats are beached. The men need no orders. We hear the chants of the Karkans behind us. One boat launches, then another and another. Shrike! Dex pulls me toward a boat. You have to go! Not until the rest of the boats launch, I say. 425 men. Gone. And Arvatus. Gone. Skies, it was so quick. The sounds of swords clashing echoes from the path above. My hammer is in my hand, and I am racing up the path. If some of my men are still up there, then by the skies I will not let them fight alone. Shrike, no! Dex groans, draws his sim, and follows. Just beyond the entrance to the path, we find a group of marshals, three masks among them, battling the Tundarans, but been inexorably shoved back by the sheer number of them. A group of orcs supports a fourth mask, blood pouring from his neck, from a wound in his gut, from another in his thigh. Harper. Dex grabs him from the orcs, staggering under his weight as he carries him down toward the last boat. The orcs arm their bows and fire over and over until the air is buzzing with arrows, and it is a miracle I am not hit. One of the masks turns. It is Baristus, my cousin.
"We'll hold them off," he shouts. "Go, Shrike! Warn the city! Warn the Emperor! Tell them there's another!"
And then Dex is dragging me away, shoving me down the path and into the boat, sharking through the water as he pushes off.
"Tell them what?"
I want to scream. Dex rows with all his might, and the boat is through the falls and moving swiftly down the fast-flowing river. I kneel beside Harper. His blood is everywhere. If it weren't me in this boat beside him, he would be dead in a matter of minutes. I take his hand. If it weren't for Baristus's sacrifice, we'd all be dead. I expect to search for Harper's song. He is the consummate mask, his thoughts and emotions buried so deeply that I assumed his song would be equally opaque. But his song is near the surface, strong and bright and clear as a star-filled winter sky. I delve into his essence. I see the smile of a dark-haired woman with wide-set green eyes, his mother, and the strong hands of a man who looks strikingly similar to Elias. Harper walks Blackcliff's dark halls and endures day after day of the hardship and loneliness I know so well. He aches for his father, a mysterious figure who haunts him with an emptiness he can never quite fill. He is an open book, and I learn that he did set Lyra free months ago when we ambushed her. He set her free because he knew I would kill her, and he knew Elias would never forgive me for it. I witness myself through his eyes, angry and cold and weak and strong and brave and warm. Not the Bloodshrike. Helene. And I would be blind not to see what he feels for me. I am woven into his consciousness, the way Elias used to be woven into mine. Harper is always aware of where I am, of whether I am all right. When his wounds have closed and his heart beats strong, I stop singing, weakened. Dex looks at me with a wild, questioning expression, but says nothing. I adjust Harper's head so he is more comfortable, and his eyes open. I am about to scold him, but his harsh whisper silences me.
"Grimar and the men who hit the rear guard came from the east, Shrike," he rasps, determined to deliver the message. "He attacked me, would have killed me."
All the more reason to hate that swine. "They must have snuck around us somehow," I say, "or perhaps they were waiting."
"No."
Avitas grabs a strap on my armor.
"They came from the east. I sent a scout because I had a hunch. There's another force. They split their army, Shrike. They don't have just 50,000 men marching on Antium. They have twice that."
Chapter 44 Lyra. At first, I don't know what to say to Cook, Mother, Mira. I watch her with wild eyes, part of me desperate to understand her story, and the other part wanting to scream out the pain of a dozen years without her until she throbs with it. Perhaps, I think to myself, she will wish to talk, to explain why she survived, how she survived. I do not expect her to justify what she did in the prison. She's not aware that I know of it, but I hope she will tell me why she kept her identity hidden. I hope she will at least apologize for it. Instead, she is silent, all her thought bent on moving swiftly across the countryside. Her face, her profile are burned into me. I see her in a thousand ways, even if she doesn't see herself. I find myself drawn to her. She was gone for so many years, and I do not wish to hold on to my anger. I do not want to fight with her like the one I had with Darin. On the first night we travel together, I sit down beside her by the fire. What did I hope for? Perhaps for the woman who called me Cricket and rested her hand on my head, heavy and gentle. The woman whose smile was a flash in the dark, the last joyful thing I could remember for years. But the moment I get close, she clears her throat and shifts away from me. It's only a few inches, but I understand her meaning. In her rasping voice, she asks me about Izzy and about what has happened to me since I left Blackcliff. Part of me doesn't want to answer. You don't deserve to know. You don't deserve to have my story. But the other part, the part that sees a broken woman where my mother once lived, is not so cruel. So I tell her of Izzy, of her sacrifice, of my foolhardiness. I tell her of the Nightbringer, of Keenan and how he betrayed not just me, but our entire family. What must she think of me to have fallen in love with the creature whose deceit led to those dark days in Koff Prison? I wait for her judgment, but she offers none. Instead, she nods, her hands curled into fists, and disappears into the dark night. In the morning, she says nothing of it. For the next few nights, every time I so much as move, she flinches, as if worried I will come closer. So I stay far away from her, always on the other side of the fire, always a few yards behind her on the road. My mind churns, but I do not speak. It is as if her silence chokes me. But finally, the words will no longer stay down, and I find that I must say them, whatever the consequences. Why didn't you kill her? The night is warm, and we don't light a fire, instead laying out our bedrolls and looking up at the stars. The Commandant. You could have poisoned her, stabbed her. For sky's sake, your mirror of Sarah. There is no mirror of Sarah. Cook shrieks so loudly that a pack of sparrows takes flight from a nearby tree, as frightened as I am. She's dead. She died in Koff Prison, when her child and husband died. I'm not Mira. I'm Cook. And you will not speak to me of that murderous, traitorous bitch, or what she would or wouldn't do. You know nothing of her. She breathes heavily, her dark eyes sparkling with rage. I tried, girl, she hisses at me. The first time I attacked Kerris, she broke my arm and lashed Izzy to within an inch of her life. The child was five. I was forced to watch. The next time I got it in my head to try something, the bitch of Blackcliff took out Izzy's eye. Why not escape? You could have gotten out of there. I tried. But the chances Kerris would catch us were too high. She'd have tortured Izzy, and I'd had enough of people suffering for me. Perhaps Mira of Sarah would have been willing to sacrifice a child to save her own neck. But that's because Mira of Sarah had no soul. Mira of Sarah was as evil as the Commandant. And I'm not her. Not anymore. You haven't asked about Nan and Pop, I whisper. Or about Darin. I don't deserve to know how your brother is, she says. As for your grandparents, her mouth splits into a small smile I do not recognize. I had vengeance on their killer. The mask, I say. How? I hunted him. He wanted to die in the end. I was merciful. Her eyes are black as dead coals. You're judging me. I wanted to kill him too, but I enjoyed it. And that makes me evil. Come now, girl. You cannot walk in the shadows as long as I have and not become one. I shift uncomfortably, remembering what the Jarduna said to me. You are young to stand so deeply in the shadow. I am glad you killed him. I pause, considering my next words. But in the end, There is no delicate way to ask the question. Why? Why won't you touch me? Don't you long for it, I want to say, the way I do? The touch of a child brings a mother comfort. I can barely hear her. But I'm no mother girl. I'm a monster. Monsters don't merit comfort. She turns away from me and falls silent. I watch her back for a long time. She's so close. Close enough to touch. Close enough to hear whispered words of forgiveness.
But I do not think that she would feel the embrace of a daughter
if I touched her. And I do not think she would care about being forgiven. The closer we get to Antium, the clearer it is that trouble is nigh. Cartloads of carpets and furniture trundle away from the city, their owners surrounded by dozens of guards. Once we see a heavily armed caravan from afar. I cannot see what they carry, but I count at least a dozen, masks guarding whatever it is. They're running, Cook spits, too scared to stay and fight. Mostly Illustrians, it seems. Move faster, girl. If the wealthy flee the city, the Karkans must be close. We do not stop now, traveling day and night, but by the time we reach the outskirts of Antium, it is clear that disaster has already struck the marshal's fabled capital. We hike over a ridge near the Argent Hills, and the city comes into view below. As does the enormous army that surrounds it on three sides. Only the north end of Antium, which abuts the mountains, is protected. Sweet bleeding skies, Cook murmurs. If that's not skies given justice, I don't know what is. So many. I can barely speak. The people in the city. I shake my head and immediately my thoughts go to the scholars who are still enslaved in this city. My people. There must be scholars down there. The Commandant didn't kill all the slaves. The Illustrians didn't let her. What happens to them if the city is overrun? They die, Cook says, just like every other poor bastard unfortunate enough to get stuck there. Leave that to the marshals. It's their capital. They'll defend it. You've got something else to think about? How the bleeding hells are we going to get in there? They've only just gotten here. Men stream in to join the Karkan army from a northeastern pass. They're staying out of range of the city's catapults, which means they must not be planning to attack. You said you could sneak us in. From the mountains north of the city, Cook says. We'd have to go around the Argent Hills.
It would take us days.
Longer. There will be chaos as they set up camp, I say. We could take advantage of that. Sneak through at night. They'll have some women down there. Whores, Cook says.
Don't think I'd pass as one of those.
Cooks too, I say. Laundresses? The Karkans are horrible. They'd not go anywhere without their women to scrape and serve for them. I could go invisible. Cook shakes her head. You said the invisibility altered your mind. Gave you visions, sometimes for hours. We need to think of something else. This is a bad idea. It's necessary. It's suicide. It's something you might have done, I say quietly. Before. That makes me trust it even less, she says. But I can see her waver. She knows as well as I do that our options are limited. An hour later, I walk by her side as she hunches over a basket of stinking laundry. We've taken out two sentries who blocked our way into the encampment. Simple enough. But now that we walk among the Karkans, it is anything but. There are so many of them. Much like in the Empire, their skin tones and features and hair vary. But they are all heavily tattooed, the top halves of their faces blue with woad, so that the whites of their eyes stand out eerily. There are hundreds of campfires lit, but few tents behind which Cook and I can take cover. Most of the men wear leather breeches and fur vests, and I have no sense of which are higher ranking and which are not. The only Korkans who stand out are those who wear strange bone and steel armor, and who carry staffs with human skulls on top. When they walk, they are given a wide berth, but most are gathered around enormous unlit pyres, pouring what looks to be deep scarlet sand in intricate shapes around them.
"Korkan warlocks," Cook mutters to me, "spend all their time terrifying the masses and attempting to raise spirits. They never manage it, but they're still treated like gods."
The camp stinks of sweat and rancid vegetables. Huge piles of firewood belie the warm weather, and the Korkans don't bother cleaning up all the horse dung. Jugs of some pale alcohol are as ubiquitous as the men, and there's a stench of sour milk that lingers over everything.
"Bah!"
an older Korkan shoves Cook when she accidentally bumps him with her basket.
"Tek vidgayad, Erkin!"
Cook swings her head back and forth, playing the old, confused woman well. The man knocks the basket out of her hands, and his friends laugh as clothes cascade onto the filthy ground. He kicks her in the gut as she tries to gather up the clothes quickly, making lewd gestures. I quickly help her gather the clothes, trusting that the Korkans are too drunk to notice an invisible hand helping Cook. But when I crouch, she hisses at me.
"You're flickering, girl. Move!"
Sure enough, I look down to find my invisibility faltering. The Nightbringer. He must be in Antium. His presence is snuffing out my magic. Cook bolts swiftly through the knot of men, making her way steadily north.
"You still there, girl?"
Tension is thick on her skin, but she doesn't look back. "They're not very organized," I whisper in return. "But skies, there are so many of them."
"Long winters in the south," Cook says. "They've got nothing to do but breed."
"Why strike now?" I ask. "Why here?"
"There's a famine among their people and a firebrand warlock who has taken advantage of it. Nothing motivates a man like hunger in the bellies of his children. The Korkans looked north and saw a wealthy fat empire. Year after year, the marshals had plenty and the Korkans had nothing. Empire wouldn't trade fairly with them either. Grimar, their warlock priest, reminded them of that. And here we are."
We are nearly through the northern end of the camp now. A flat cliff face stretches ahead of us, but Cook makes her way confidently toward it, shedding the basket of laundry as darkness falls and we get farther from the camp.
"They're depending entirely on sheer numbers to win here. That, or they've got something nasty up their sleeves. Something the marshals can't fight."
I glance up at the moon, almost full, but not quite. In 3 days, it will fatten into the grain moon. By the grain moon, the forgotten will find their master. Cook doubles back twice to make sure we aren't followed before she gestures me close to the cliff face. She nods upward.
"There's a cave, about 50 feet up," she says. "Leads deeper into the mountains. Stay here and stay invisible. Just in case."
"How the hells are you going to—" she crooks her fingers.
There is something familiar about the motion, and then suddenly she is climbing the sheer rock face with the spryness of a spider. I gape. It is unnatural. No, impossible. She is not flying exactly, but there is a lightness to her that is distinctly inhuman.
"What the hells?"
A rope falls and smacks me in the head. Cook's face appears from overhead.
"Tied around you," she says. "Brace your feet on the wall, in the wedges, in whatever space you can find, and climb."
When I finally reach her, I am out of breath, and when I ask her how she did it, she hisses at me and starts off through the cave without turning back. We are deep in the mountains before Cook finally suggests I drop my invisibility.
"It might take me a few minutes to wake up," I say to her. "I have visions, and I'm not sure.
I'll make sure you don't die."
I nod, but find myself paralyzed. I do not wish to face the visions, not after what the Nightbringer showed me. Though my mother cannot see me, she cocks her head as if she senses my discomfort. My face flushes, and though I search for an explanation, I cannot find one. I'm a coward, I want to say. I always have been. Skies, this is humiliating. If she would just cook, I would not have cared. But she is my mother. My mother. I have spent years wondering what she would think of me. She looks around the tunnel and finally sits on the earth floor. I'm tired, she says. Damn Corkins. Come, sit next to an old woman, girl. I ease down beside her, and for the first time, she doesn't flinch away from me, because she can't see me. These visions, she says after a time. They are frightening. I think of her in the prison cell, the singing, the crack, those sounds that meant nothing until they meant everything. And even now, even when I do not comprehend who she has become, I cannot bear to tell her what I saw. I cannot say it, for saying it will make it real. Yes, I dig my feet into the ground, sliding them back and forth. They're frightening. And what will I see now that the visions turn out to be from the past? Something else, some other horror. Best get it done. Quickly, then. Her voice is not exactly gentle, but it isn't harsh, either. She hesitates and holds out a hand, palm up. Her jaw is tight, and she swallows. Her skin is warm, calloused, and though she might not look like my mother, or sound like her, or act like her, she still has her hands. I squeeze, and she shudders. I shrug off the invisibility, welcoming the visions because they cannot be worse than holding the hand of a woman who bore me, but who is disgusted by my touch. The visions are upon me, but this time I walk through streets of fire, past walls burned black. Screams echo from blazing buildings, and dread fills my bones. I cry out. When I open my eyes, Cook is hovering over me. One hand on my face, the other still clenched between my fingers. Her face is pained, as if touching me is more than she can bear. She doesn't ask about the visions, and I do not tell her. When we approach the entrance to the Mariner Embassy, a wet, crumbling set of steps that lead up to a wooden door, Cook slows. There should be two guards here. He says. It has always been guarded. That lever there, it allows them to collapse the whole damn thing in case of an attack. I draw my dagger, and Cook draws her bow. She pushes the door open gently, and when we enter, all is silent. In the streets beyond the building, drums thunder, and I am transported back to Blackcliff almost instantly. Carts rumble past. Their occupants shouting requests, soldiers bellowing orders. Boots thump, marching in time, and a crisp voice directs a platoon to the walls. Antium prepares for war. This isn't right, I say. Musa had people here. They were to have slaves' cuffs ready for us. Maps. The Bloodshrike's movements. They must have left before the Corkins attack. Cook says. They can't all have gone. But they have. I can feel it. This place has been empty for days. We're on our own.
Chapter 45. Elias. The ghosts explode into the Empire like flaming stones hurtling from a ballista. The border wall is nothing but shreds. I feel the spirits in the same way that I feel the contours of the waiting place. They're bits of winter in a blanket of warmth, and they move like a school of fish, closely packed and streaking in one direction, southwest toward a martial village I sneak supplies from. The people who live there are decent and hardworking, and they've no bleeding idea what's coming. I want to help them, but that's also what the djinn want, for it's a distraction from my duty. Yet again, they're trying to use my humanity against me. Not this time. What matters now is not the humans whom the ghosts will possess and torment. It's the border of the waiting place. I have to restore it. There will be more ghosts entering the forest. They, at least, must be kept within its boundaries. The thought has scarcely formed in my mind when the magic rises from the earth, winding its way into my body. It's stronger this time, as if sensing that finally I understand how I've been manipulated by the djinn. Feeling Ma'atha, letting the magic consume me, is a relief, but also a transgression. I shudder at Ma'atha's closeness. This doesn't feel like using my physical magic, which is simply a matter of harnessing something that's already part of me. No, this magic is something alien. It sinks in like a disease and colors my sight. The magic changes something fundamental within. I do not feel like myself. But my discomfort can wait. I have more pressing work. The magic allows me to see what the border should look like. All I need to do is apply my willpower to rebuild it. I gather my strength. Far to the south, the ghosts close in on the village. Don't think about it. Ma'atha's magic flares in response, his presence stronger. Section by section, I rebuild the border, imagining great bricks of light rising all at once, solid and unbreakable. When I open my eyes, the wall is there, glowing as if it never came down. The border cannot call the escaped ghosts back, but it can catch new ghosts who are bound for the waiting place. And there will be many of those. Now what? Do I go after the rogue ghosts? A nudge from Ma'atha toward the southwest is my answer. The windwalking comes easily, more easily than it ever has. And though I expect the magic to wear off the farther I get from the forest, it stays with me. For this is Ma'atha's magic, not my own. The ghosts have scattered, splintering among the countryside into dozens of small groups. But I make for the village closest to the waiting place. When I am still a mile away, I hear screams. I slow in a village square, and it is a testament to the havoc the ghosts have created that none of the villagers seem to notice that I appeared out of thin air.
Thaddeus, my son, no!
A white-haired man screams. A younger man twists the old man's arms behind his back and pulls them up with inhuman, inexorable force.
Release me! Don't do this! Ah!
An audible crunch sounds, and the father slumps, unconscious from pain. The younger man lifts him up, as if he's nothing but a pebble, and flings him across the village, hundreds and hundreds of yards. I draw my Sims, prepared to attack, when Ma'atha yanks at me. Of course, Elias, you idiot, I chide myself. I can't single-handedly beat up everyone inhabited by a ghost. Shaver tapped my heart, my head.
Ma'atha's true power is here and here.
The magic nudges me toward the closest group of possessed villagers. My throat grows warm, and I can sense somehow that Ma'atha wants me to speak.
Stop!
I say, but not as Elias. I speak as the Banu al-Ma'atha. I pinion the possessed with my gaze, one by one. I wait for an attack, but all they do is stare balefully, wary of the magic they can sense roiling within me.
Come!
I order them. My voice booms with a supernatural note of command. They must listen.
Come!
They snarl and yip, and I cast Ma'atha's magic out like a thin line, wrapping it around each of them, tugging them close. Some come in the bodies they have stolen, others are still spirits, and they drift toward me with hostile moans. Soon, A small group of a few dozen spirits forms a half circle around me. Should I rope them together with magic? Send them streaming back to the waiting place, as I did with the ghosts that plagued the tribes? No, for as I look at these tortured faces, I realize the spirits don't wish to be here. They want to move on, to leave this world. Sending them back to the forest will only prolong their suffering. The magic fills my sight, and I see the ghosts for what they are, hurting, alone, confused, regretful. Some are desperate for forgiveness, others for kindness, others for understanding, others for an explanation. But a few require judgment, and those spirits take longer to deal with, for they must suffer the hurt they inflicted on others before they are free. Each time I recognize what a spirit needs, I find myself willing it forth from the magic and giving it to them. It takes time. Long minutes pass, and I get through a dozen ghosts, then two dozen. Soon all the ghosts in the vicinity flock to me, desperate to speak, desperate for me to see them. The villagers cry out for help, perhaps hoping my magic will offer them respite from their pain. I glance at them and see not humans, but lesser creatures who are dying slowly. The humans are mortal, unimportant. The ghosts are all that matter. The thought feels unfamiliar, strange, as if it doesn't belong to me. But I have no time to dwell on it, for more ghosts await. I fix my gaze on them, barely twitching until the last of them has moved on, even those who found human bodies to squat in. When I finish, I observe the devastation they've left behind. There are a dozen dead bodies that I can see, and probably dozens more that I can't. Distantly, I feel something. Sadness? I push it aside quickly. The villagers look at me with terror now. They're simple creatures, after all. In any case, it's only a matter of time before fear transforms into torches and sims and pitchforks. I'm still mortal, and I've no wish to fight them. A young man steps forward, a hesitant look on his face. He opens his mouth, his lips forming the words, "Thank you." Before he can finish, I turn away. There is much work ahead of me, and in any case, I don't deserve his thanks. Days pass in a blur of villages and towns. I find the ghosts, call to them, gather them close, and send them on. In some villages, doing so takes only an hour. In others, it takes nearly an entire day. My connection to Ma'atha grows stronger, but it's not complete. I know it in my bones. The magic holds back, and I will not be a true soul catcher until I find a way to merge with it fully. Soon, the magic is powerful enough that I can hone in quickly on where the ghosts are. I send hundreds on. Thousands remain. And hundreds more ghosts have been created, for the spirits wreak havoc wherever they go. One evening, I reach a town where nearly everyone is already dead, and the ghosts have already moved on to another town. Nearly 3 weeks after the ghosts' escape, when night has fallen and a storm has broken over the land, I take shelter on a grassy knoll, free of boulders and scrum, just a few miles from a martial garrison. The drums of the garrison thunder, unusual this late at night, but I pay them no mind, not even bothering to translate. Shivering in my soaked leather armor, I gather a bundle of sticks. But the rain doesn't let up, and after a half hour of trying to light the damn fire, I abandon it and hunch miserably beneath my hood. "What's the use?" I mutter to myself. "Of having magic if I can't use it to make a fire." I expect no response, so when the magic rises, I am surprised. More so when it hovers over me, creating an invisible, cocoon-like shelter. "Ah, thank you?" I poke at the magic with a finger. It has no substance, just a sense of warmth. I didn't know it could do this.
There is so much you do not yet know. Did Shaver know Ma'atha well? She was always so deeply respectful of the magic, fearful even. And like a child who watches his parents' faces for cues, I picked up on that wariness. Did the magic feel anything when Shaver died, I wonder? She was bound to that place for 1,000 years. Did Ma'atha care? Did he feel angry at the Nightbringer's foul crime? I shudder when I think of the Djinn Lord, when I think of who he was, a soul catcher who passed the spirits of humans on with such love, versus what he has become, a monster who wants nothing more than to annihilate us. In the stories Mamie told, he was only ever called the King of No Name or the Nightbringer. But I wonder if he had a true name, one us humans never deserved to know. Though it's discomforting, I am forced to admit that the Djinn were wronged, grievously wronged, which doesn't make what the Nightbringer has done right, but it does complicate my view of the world and my ability to look on him with unadulterated hatred. When I finally arise, warm and dry due to Ma'atha's shelter, it's long before dawn. Immediately, I'm aware of a shift in the fabric of the world. The ghosts I'd sensed lurking in the surrounding countryside are gone. And there is something else, some new fey darkness in the world. I can't see it, and yet I know it exists. I stand up, scanning the rolling farmland around me. The garrison is to the north. Then there are a few hundred miles of Illustrian estates. Then the capital, the Neverness Range, Delphinium. The magic strains north, as if wishing to drag me in that direction. As I reach out with my mind, I feel it. Chaos, blood, a battle, and more ghosts. Except these do not come from the waiting place. They are fresh, new, and imprisoned by a strange fey magic that I have never before seen. What in the 10 hells? The ghosts are, I know, sometimes drawn to conflict, blood. Could there be a battle in the north? At this time of year, Tiberium is often harassed by the Empire's enemies, but Tiberium is due west. Ma'atha nudges me to my feet, and I windwalk north, my mind ranging out over miles. I finally come across a cluster of ghosts, and just ahead of it, another. More of the spirits arrow toward a specific place, wild with hunger and rage. They yearn toward bodies, toward bloodshed, toward war. I know it as surely as if the ghosts tell me themselves. What's bleeding war, though? I think, bewildered. Are the Karkans murdering wildmen in the Neverness again? If so, that must be where the ghosts are headed. The drums of a nearby garrison thunder. And this time I listen. Karkan attack imminent. All reserve soldiers to report to South River Barracks immediately. The message repeats, and I finally understand that the ghosts are not, in fact, headed to the Neverness. They are headed to Antium.
Part 4. Siege.
Chapter 46. The Bloodshrike. The Karkans have no catapults, no siege towers, no battering rams, no artillery. What in the bleeding hells, I say to Dex and Arvatas as I look out over the vast force, is the point of having 100,000 men if you are just going to let them sit outside a city burning through food and supplies for 3 days? Maybe this is why the Commandant plotted with the Karkans to sneak up on Antium. She knew they'd be stupid enough that we could destroy them quickly, but not so stupid that she couldn't use the chaos they caused to her advantage. They are fools, Dex says, convinced that because they have such a large force, they will take the city. Or perhaps we are the fools. Marcus speaks from behind me, and the men on the wall swiftly kneel. The Emperor gestures us up and strides forward, his honor guard in lockstep behind him. And they have something else planned. My lord? The Emperor stands beside me, hyena eyes narrowing as they sweep across the Karkan army. The sun fades, and night will soon be upon us. My brother speaks to me from beyond death, Shrike. Marcus sounds calm, and there is no hint of instability in his demeanor. He says the Karkans bring warlock priests, one of whom is the most powerful in their history, and that these warlocks summon darkness. They have no siege weaponry, because they do not need it. He pauses. Is the city prepared? We'll hold, my lord, for months if need be. Marcus's mouth twists. He's keeping secrets. What? What are you not telling me? We'll know by the grain moon if we will hold, he says, with a chilling surety. I stiffen. The grain moon is in 3 bleeding days. The augurs have seen it. Your Majesty, Caris Veturia appears from the stairs leading up to the wall. I ordered her to shore up the eastern gates, which are the strongest, and which keeps her far from both Marcus and Livia. My spies report that she is not deviating from her assigned task. For now, anyway. I'd wanted to get her away from the city, but the plebeians support her enthusiastically, and getting rid of her will only undermine Marcus further. She has too many damned allies, but at the very least, she's lost much of her illustrian support. The paters have, it appears, remained in their own villas the past few days, no doubt preparing for the battle to come. A messenger from the Karkans has arrived, Caris says. They seek terms. Though Caris insists on Marcus staying behind, yet another play for power, he waves her off, and the 3 of us ride out, joined by Arvatas at my side, and by Marcus's personal guard, who form a protective half-moon around him. The Karkan who approaches us rides alone, bare-chested and without a flag of truce. Half of his milk-pale body is covered in woad, the other half in crude tattoos. His hair is lighter than mine, his eyes practically colourless against the woad he's used to blue them out. The stallion he rides on is enormous, and he is nearly as tall as Elias. A necklace of bones circles his thick neck twice. Finger bones, I realize when we are closer. Though I only saw him distantly in Navium, I know him immediately. Grimar, the warlock priest.
Do you have so few men, heathen?
He looks between Caris and I.
That you must ask your women to fight.
I was planning to cut off your head, Marcus says with a grin, after I'd stuffed your manhood down your throat. But I think I'll let you live, just so I can watch Caris gut you slowly.
The Commandant says nothing. She meets Grimar's eyes briefly, a look that tells me, sure as if she'd spoken it, that they have met before. She knew he was coming, and she knew he was coming with 100,000 men. What did she promise this monster of a man, that he would do her bidding and bring a war to Antium, all so she could take the Empire? Despite the fact that the Karkans appear to have no war strategy, Grimar is no fool. He nearly bested us in Navium. He must be getting something more than a weeks-long siege out of this.
Deliver your message quickly.
Marcus pulls out a blade and casually polishes it.
I'm already wondering if I should change my mind. My brother Vorlox and I demand that you give up the city of Antium. If you do so immediately, your elderly will be exiled instead of executed, your fighting men enslaved instead of tortured and put to the pyre, and your women and daughters taken to wife and converted instead of raped and debased. If you do not give up the city, we will take it by the grain moon. This I vow to you on the blood of my mother and father
and unborn children.
Avitas and I exchange a glance. The green moon. Again.
How do you plan to take the city? I say. You have no siege machines.
Silence, heathen! I speak to your master.
Grimar keeps his attention on Marcus, even as my hand itches for my warhammer.
Your answer, my lord? You and your corpse-stroking warlocks can take your terms with you to the Hells, where we will shortly send you.
Very well,
Grimar shrugs, as if he expected no less, and wheels his horse away. When we are back within the city, Marcus turns to Karis and me.
They will strike within the hour.
My lord emperor, Karis says,
how? They will strike, and we must be ready, for it will be swift and hard.
Marcus is distracted, head tilted as he listens to whatever secrets his brother's ghost whispers.
I will command the men at the western gate. Karis, the shrike will inform you of your duties.
His cape whips behind him as he walks away, and I turn to Karis. Take the eastern wall, I say. The defense is weakest near the central gate. Hold it, or the first level will be overrun. The commandant salutes, and though her face is carefully neutral, I can sense the smugness rolling off of her. What the bleeding hells is she up to now? Karis, perhaps this is a lost cause, but I say it anyway. I know this was you, I say. All of it. I assume you believe you can hold off the Karkans long enough to rid yourself of Marcus and Livia. Long enough to rid yourself of me. She merely watches me. I know what you desire, I say. And this siege you've brought upon the city tells me how badly you wish for it. But there are hundreds of thousands of marshals.
You don't know what I want, Karis says softly. But you will. Soon.
She turns and stalks away, the plebeians nearby cheering her name as she passes. What the bleeding hells is that supposed to mean? I turn to Avitas, who is at my back. My hand is slick, clenched around the hilt of my dagger. My every instinct screams that something is wrong, that I have irrevocably underestimated Karis. She wants the Empire, I say to Avitas. What else could she possibly be after? He doesn't get a chance to answer. Panicked shouts rise from the wall. When Avitas and I reach the walkway that runs along the massive structure, I understand why. The sky is illuminated by the light of scores of pyres. Skies only know how Grimar disguised them, because I'd have sworn those pyres weren't there moments ago. Now they dominate the field, their flames shooting high into the sky. Grimar circles the largest pyre, muttering incantations. From this distance, I should not be able to hear him. Yet the malice of his magic taints the very air, the words snaking beneath my skin. Ready the catapults! I give Dex the order. Ready the archers! The Emperor was right. They're making their move. Down in the Karkan camp, bound figures are brought toward the pyres, twisting in panic. At first I think they are animals, part of some sort of ritual sacrifice. Howls fill the air, and I realize it is a sacrifice.
Bleeding hells, Dex says. Are those women?
My stomach churns. And children. Their screams echo across the Karkan camp, and when one of my men retches over the wall, I cannot blame him. Even from here I can smell burned flesh. Grimar chants, and the Karkans echo him, soon accompanied by the steady, deep beat of a drum. The marshals on the wall are well and truly rattled now, but I walk back and forth among them.
Courage in the face of their barbaric ways, I shout. Courage, lest they bring their darkness upon us all.
The chanting slows, each word drawn out longer, until it is one unending low hum that seems to arise from the earth itself. A distant howl tears through the air, high-pitched, like the screams of those on the pyres, but with an unearthly tinge that raises the hair on my arms. The pyres go out. The sudden darkness is blinding. As my eyes adjust, I realize the humming has stopped. Scraps of white rise from the pyres, looking for all the world like ghosts, Harper says. They're summoning ghosts. From the Karkin camp, screams arise from the men as the ghosts turn on them and plunge into the army, disappearing. Some of the men appear unchanged, others jerk as if battling something none of us can see, their unnatural movements visible even from here. Silence descends. Then the thunder of feet, thousands upon thousands of people moving at once. They're rushing the walls, I say disbelievingly. Why would they? Look at them, Shrike, Harper whispers. Look at how they're moving. The Karkins are indeed rushing the walls, but they run with inhuman speed. When they reach the forest of pikes, poking out of the ground 200 yards from Antium, instead of impaling themselves, the Karkins leap over them with unnatural strength. Shouts of alarm sound from the marshals as the Karkins come closer. Even from a distance, their eyes glow a startling pure white. They're possessed by the ghosts raised by their warlocks. Arvatas, I say so quietly that no one else can hear. The evacuation plan. It is ready? All are in place? You have cleared the way? Yes, Shrike. Harper turns from the approaching horde. All is prepared. Then see it done. He hesitates, about to launch a protest, but I am already moving. Catapults! I call to the drummer, who pounds out the message. Fire at will! Within seconds, the catapults rumble and flaming projectiles fly over the walls toward the possessed Karkins. Many go down, but more dodge the projectiles, moving with that eerie speed. Archers! I shout. Fire at will! With breathtaking swiftness, Grimmar's possessed soldiers have blown past the markers we set out on the field. A hail of flaming arrows rains down on the Karkins. It hardly slows them. I order the archers to fire again and again. Some of the Karkins fall, but not enough. No wonder they didn't have any bleeding siege machines. An alarm goes up from the men, and less than 100 yards away, a group of possessed Karkins lift massive, glowing missiles, seemingly unbothered by their flames, and fling them at Antium. It's not possible, I whisper. How can they? The missiles fly into the city, smashing into buildings and soldiers and watchtowers. The drummers immediately issue a call for the water brigades. The archers fire volley after volley, and legionnaires reload the catapults as fast as they can. As the Karkins close on the walls, I hear their hungry, beast-like snarls. Too quickly, they are past the trenches, past the secondary forest of pikes planted at the base of the walls to deflect a human army. We have no defense now. In the space of minutes, the battle will go from strategy and tactics thought up in a distant room to the short, desperate strokes of men fighting for their next breath. So be it. The Karkins begin to scale the wall, brandishing their weapons as if they are possessed by demons of the hells. I draw my warhammer, and then I roar the attack.
Chapter 47. Liar. The soldier's uniform is far too big, and there's an unpleasant wetness across the small of my back. The previous owner must have taken a blow to the kidney, and he must have spent a long time dying. Fortunately, the uniform is black, so no one notices the blood as I move through the lines of soldiers along the southern wall of Antium, doling out dippers of water. My hair is tucked tightly into a helm, and I have gloves on to hide my hands. I slump my shoulders beneath the yoke across my back and shuffle my feet. But, tired as they are, the soldiers hardly notice me. I could probably strip down to skivvies and run up and down the wall, screaming, I burned down Blackcliff! and they wouldn't care. A light flashes on my helmet, Cook's signal. Finally. It has been 2 days since we arrived in Antium, 2 days since the Korkans unleashed their hordes of possessed, white-eyed soldiers upon the city, 2 days of bone-shaking attacks and streets crumbled to dust, 2 days of men with unnatural strength pelting the city with flaming missiles while the air is choked with screams. Above it all, the buzz of arrows as thousands are unleashed on the forces arrayed outside the city's gates. I have posed as a sweeper, a slops collector, a squire, all in an attempt to get close to the blood shrike. I have tried to use my invisibility, but no matter how much willpower I pour into it, I have been unable to harness it, which means the Nightbringer must be nearby. He is the only thing that has kept me from drawing on my magic in the past. Thus, the disguises, not that any of them have helped. The blood shrike leads the defense of the city, and she is everywhere at once. In the few glimpses I have had of her, her ringed hand has been clenched around her blood-drenched warhammer. The light flashes on my helm again, this time with an air of impatience. I back away from the line of men, hurrying off as if to get more water, though the buckets attached to the pole across my back are not even half empty yet. A missile hits the wall just behind me, and the explosion slams me to my knees, sending the buckets flying. I shudder, every part of my body hurting, a shrill keen in my ears at the sound of the impact. Get up, liar! I scramble for the buckets and run from where other soldiers are falling. The missile has left a smoking crater in the earth below the wall, where a group of soldiers and scholar slaves had been standing only moments ago. The stench makes me gag. I make my way across the lower level of the wall, up a set of stairs, to the walkway at the top. I keep my head down. This is the closest I've gotten to the shrike. I cannot make a mistake now. The mirror flashes again, this time to my left. Cook is telling me which way to go, and I follow the flash, ignoring cries for water, pretending that I have some place more important to be. I spy the shrike ahead of me, blood-drenched and slumped with exhaustion. Her armor is gouged in a dozen places, her hair a mess. Her ringed hand hangs loose. When I am 30 feet away, I slow my pace. When I am 10 feet from her, I clutch at the pole I hold and sling it down as if preparing to take water to the soldiers around her. Skies, she is so close, and she has, for once, put down that damned hammer. All I have to do is get my hands on the ring. The moment I do, Cook will launch her distraction, which she has refused to tell me about, for fear of the Nightbringer learning of it and sabotaging us. Now the shrike is a mere few feet from me. My mouth is suddenly dry, my feet heavy. Just get your hands on the ring. Get it off her. I should have practiced. Cook spent what little time we had trying to teach me the art of pickpocketing. But in truth, I have no idea how to filch a ring. What if it is tight on her? What if I yank at it and it does not come off? What if she curls her hand into a fist? What if... A tickle on my neck, a premonition, a warning that something comes. I scurry a few feet farther away from the shrike and dole out dippers of water to grateful men. The light ahead shifts strangely, a contortion in the air that births a slice of night's shadow. The blood shrike senses it as I do, and stands, her hand fisted around her warhammer once more. Then she takes a step back as the shadows coalesce. It is him, the Nightbringer. I am not alone in backing away from him, and it is that saves me from his gaze. All of the soldiers around the shrike are in as much of a hurry to escape the djinn's attention as I am.
Shrike,
his grating, grinding voice makes me shudder.
Heres Veturia seeks your counsel. For she...
I do not hear the rest. I am halfway down the stairs, buckets abandoned, mission aborted.
What the hells?
Cook meets me when I've gotten well away from the wall. I hear the unmistakable whistle of another missile falling.
We had a plan, girl.
It didn't work. I yank my helm off, not caring who sees, knowing it will not make a difference anyway. Not in this chaos. He was there. The Nightbringer, right next to her. He would have seen me. I shake my head. We have to find another way. We need to lure her to us. But short of holding the Emperor hostage, I don't know what would work. Cook takes my shoulders and turns me toward the wall. We are going back there right now, she says. All we have to do is wait for him to leave. Everything is in place and we won't. An explosion tears through the air just yards away, where a group of scholar slave children are digging through rubble under the watchful eye of a martial legionnaire. I find myself flat on the ground, coughing debris from my lungs, trying to wave away the dust.
Najam!
A girl cries out. Najam! An answering cry, and then the girl's sobbing as she pulls another child from the rubble. With her eyes on the legionnaire, who is still trying to rise from the blast, the little girl grabs the boy and they begin to run, both of them limping. Cook sees me watching and drags me to my feet. Come on, girl! Those two need help, I say. We can't just... We can, and we will, Cook says. Move! The distraction I arranged will only work for so long, but it will give you enough time to get to the ring. But I cannot take my eyes off the child, who spins and searches the city around her, hunting for a way out. Her furrowed brow is far too old for her years, and her younger brother, for they are clearly siblings, looks up at her, waiting for her to tell him what they should do. She spots me and Cook, realizes that we are scholars, and rushes to us.
Please, she says, can you help us get out? We can't stay. We'll die. Mother and father and Subhan are already dead. I can't let Najam die. I promised my parents before they... I promised I'd keep him safe.
I pick up the little boy and Cook is on my heels. Damn it, liar! We cannot get that ring by sneaking it off the shrike at the wall, I hiss at her. Distraction or not, but we can save these two lives. We can do something. You've seen the tunnels. You know the way out. Get them as far as that. Give them a chance, because Skies know that if they stay in this hellhole, they will die. They'll both die. Put the child down, liar. We have a mission. Is that what you told yourself when you left us? I ask her. That you had a mission. Cook's face goes hard. You can't help them. We can give them a way out. So they can starve to death in the forest. So they can have hope. I scream at her, an eruption born of my guilt over giving up my armlet to the Nightbringer. It is born of my rage at myself for not being able to stop him. Frustration at my utter inability to do anything to help or protect or save my people. I will get you out, I tell the children. This is one promise I'm going to keep. Come on, we'll take you through the tunnels. When you come out of them, there will be a forest, and you need to go through it and into the mountains to be safe. You'll have to eat mushrooms and berries. The shrill scree of a missile rings out, growing louder by the second. It blazes with fire as it arcs downward, graceful as a falling star. And it's coming right for us.
Sissy!
Najam grabs for his sister, panicking. She yanks him from me and runs. I turn toward my mother in a panic.
Run!
I say. I feel an arm around my waist, powerful and familiar and searingly hot. The last thing I hear is a deep, scarred voice, growling as if it was born of the earth itself.
You are a fool, liar of Serha.
Then I am flung much farther than any human could throw me, and the world goes white.
Chapter 48, The Blood Shrike. I do not know how long it has been since the Karkans descended. I do not know how many I have killed. I only know how many of our men have died. I know where our enemies are starting to push through the wall. My men roll out pitch and rocks and flames. We throw everything we have at the horde swarming up ladders and attempting to overrun us. With blood and sweat and unending toil, we hold them back. But they die slowly, if at all. and they keep coming. The men slump against the wall, bloodied and exhausted. We need a victory. We need something to turn the tide. I am considering this when Dex arrives, looking as much a mess as I feel. His report is as I expected. Too many losses, too few gains. We underestimated the Karkans and overestimated our own strength in battle.
Horpa says the tunnels are full, Dex says. He's gotten about 5,000 plebeians up the Pilgrim Road already, but there are thousands left to evacuate. They're all coming out just north of Pilgrim's Gap. The land is hard to travel. It's going to take time.
Does he need men?
He has all he needs.
I nod. At least something in this sky's forsaken city is going right. And the Paters?
Their families have fled. Most of them have holed up in their houses.
We need those men out here fighting, but it would take more men to drag them out, and we don't have the manpower. The legions from Estium and Selous, which should have been pressing the attack on the Corkan army's rear guard, have been delayed by storms.
The Empress? Safe, Shrike, with Raelius and Faris. I still say we need more guards.
The Commandant will find her if we move any of her guards from the palace, I say. With just Raelius and Faris, she can remain hidden. How fare Karras's forces?
The Emperor's? The Emperor holds the western gate and refuses to be pulled from battle. They've taken the fewest losses. He's in his element. Karras holds the eastern gate, Dex says. Pater Raelius and his men are sticking to her like burrs, as you've asked, but they've taken losses. The Karkans are pushing hard. She's requested more men.
My lip curls. That traitorous hag.
You don't know what I want.
I still haven't worked out what it could be, but I know she won't sacrifice the entire capital. She'll have no one to bleeding rule over if she does. Everything that makes the Empire is here. The treasury, the Hall of Records, the Emperor's Palace. And most importantly, the people. If she allows the city to fall, she'll be Empress of nothing but ash.